You're listening to Let's Hear It. We're in the WMUK Takeda studio with the Birdseed Salesman. That was the tune Nuage, requested by me.
That one was actually written by Django.
Oh, wonderful. We talked briefly about how this group came to be. I'd love to know more on an individual level how each of you found your instrument and just how you got started playing the instruments that you did. Helen, if you'd like to start.
All right. Well, I started when I was in public school. And I started maybe third grade, I think, in like group lessons in elementary school. I didn't pick the instrument. It was picked for me. I got wind that people were like playing instruments, and I was like, oh, the flute would be really cool. Girls play flutes. And I was assigned to the violin, and I didn't complain as the good little Chinese American girl that I was. And I found that I really enjoyed it. It's just like, I don't know. It was like when you're a kid, it's kind of the successive levels of mastery, you know, kind of are the fun part of it. And so I played all through, up through high school. I started taking private lessons in violin in junior high school. At some point, somebody suggested, oh, maybe you should take. So I did that, did the junior orchestra, all the, you know, the classical thing. And when I went to college, I was just intimidated by the thought of having to audition for anything. So I didn't participate in music when I was in college. And when I got out of college and moved back to New York, the first thing I did was like, I continued music, but I had dropped the violin at that point. And I got into my first rock band because my roommate's boyfriend heard me practicing the harmonica in my bedroom. And
who knew? I didn't know you were a harmonica player. We may have to put this
former
in.
Former harmonica player.
Recovering or former?
And so that's what happened. And in this band, there was a trumpeter. And the band leader was like, oh, it'd be really cool to, you know, to do some harmonies with the trumpet. And it's like, you used to play the violin. Why don't you bring it in? And so that's how I started playing violin in non-classical styles. Yeah. And for the first time, you know, plugging it in, you know, with this really crappy pickup that I had, like a temporary thing that you jam into the bridge and it has horrible scratchy sound. But just kind of loved the idea of like playing off the page, mm-hmm. you know? And then after I stopped playing in those couple of bands, it was kind of like, what's next? And plus I had gotten tired of kind of what I could hear. I wanted to expand that. And then I started studying jazz privately. And before I started that, I didn't know what a chord symbol even meant. So it wasn't until after being in the rock bands that I started to understand a little more and learn about it.
Yeah. Because you really covered the waterfront from classical to rock harmonica to...
Do you want us to play that tune next?
I was hoping. Jay, maybe if you could talk about your history with the guitar.
Well, it's actually... leave out the training as a kid, and it's similar story to Helen's, I think. I started just learning guitar and bass and without any formal training and just picking it up as I went, and started as a teenager, like kind of getting into rock bands and writing stuff, and was really just, you know, I don't know what I was doing. I'd like to go back and like tell that kid to go to school for it, or to go to join the the band, the marching band or something, so I could learn, really know what I was doing. But then played in rock bands and so forth. And I think about 20 years ago, I've always been interested in this kind of music and also in another genre of surf music. And right now I'm in this band and also in a surf guitar band and play some folk things as well. Kind of, I don't know, just a wide range of interests, I guess, musically. But for this style, to do this, I had to be able to read those chord symbols, right? I needed to know. And also there's a chording style. There's a little bit of training on the guitar that it goes beyond what you would typically do playing guitar or bass in a rock scenario. You know, some of the chords I'm playing right now are not anything you would typically use. Yeah. So yeah, I had to, I guess about 10 or 15 years ago, I don't know, I started learning some of that stuff. And just really in the last 5 or 6 years, I've been able to, you know, sit down with Nathan or with other people and look at, you know, these charts and be able to follow along. And really recently, I would say is when I finally feel comfortable doing it. And I still, as Helen knows, I still, you know, fall off the train comes off the rails every once in a while. So yeah, I don't know. I would say while I've got the mic and while I've brought up the subject of surf music and my other band, I'm not going to talk about my other band, but I will say that one of the things that is really quite similar between the surf guitar rock genre and this genre that we're playing is that they both take popular music from any source, you know, whether like when Nathan was talking about, you know, French folk music or Broadway or just stuff that's on the radio. Both styles can take pretty much anything that has a melody and a chord progression and perform it in that style. So whether, you know, in fact, we do a song called Moonlight in Vermont, which is a, you know, it's a jazz standard, right? But we play it in the Manouche style in this group. And then in my surf band, we play it in the surf style.
Oh, cool.
And it's really similar. You know, it's just, there's a few things about your technique of how you approach it and the amount of reverb you use and adding the drums. And then I have another trio that I play in that's, you know, a little bit more of a folk trio. And we do the same tune in that group too. And all three, I think, at different keys. And in different styles, you know. Yeah. And so you can take just about anything. And really, the more popular the tune, the more people in the audience recognize the melody, yeah, the more you've got them hooked.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that's one of the things when we're playing, you know, at Martini's or whatever, when we look around the room, sometimes it's like, what? Oh, there's a bunch of kids here. Let's, you know, pick something from the Charlie Brown Christmas, you know, songbook or yeah, whatever. And because they're going to recognize that melody and but it still is in we're playing it in our style. So
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll hand the mic over to Nathan now. So he can tell you about about chicken picking.
I was going to say that this is the great secret is that we have the same repertoire between like guitar up and here, right? Where that's, right. We're playing the same tunes. No, but Jay's right. I did kind of come to gypsy jazz through chicken picking, as it were. But, you know, guitar, it gives you a lot of ways. It's a way into a lot of different kinds of music, right? Because it's a popular instrument. You know, it's a cigar box with strings, and it enables you to play, a lot of different popular styles.
Could you describe what chicken picking is for the great, the uninitiated?
Yeah, chicken picking. So Texas was home for about 10 years, and I developed a taste for country music living there, two-stepping and all the fantastic barbecue and beer that is in Texas. Chicken picking, you know, Nashville style. It's like a country music style where you're kind of muting it, kind of like the pump in some ways, but you hear different country players doing that. So yeah, Jay likes to give me a hard time for the chicken picking, and I do like to throw in a chicken picking, or we can do a little bit of a.
An homage, I mean,
there's a country lick on a Selmer style guitar, but I guess that's a pretty like fair summation of my background. Is you know, I'm not a master of any one style of music, starting off like most male guitar players, it's your puberty and you're interested in rock music. And so as a teenager, you're interested in all the guitar players from like the 1960s, all these, kind of guitar gods. And I was very interested in like Jimi Hendrix, as, any 13-year-old would be. But instead of, going forward in time, I guess I went backwards and became interested in Wes Montgomery and, the guitar players of the early 60s. And then the 1950s, one gets interested in, like Les Paul, for instance, or the Takeoff style guitar players. But then moving to Texas, I became involved in the bluegrass scene down there. Probably two or three nights a week, you could go to a bluegrass jam in Austin, and you get a flat top guitar and you're learning that flat picking style. And there's some crossover in the bluegrass scene with the jazz manouche scene, acoustic instruments, string band format, and even the repertoire overlaps. So for instance, the tune Farewell Blues, that's covered by a lot of bluegrass outfits, and it's a standard piece for in the manouche style as well. I mean, there's a recording of Django Reinhardt playing that tune. I guess my route to this music is through bluegrass, is through guitar, is through jazz, studying jazz for a long time. And this is music that is made for guitar, in ways that, Helen mentioned earlier, the ways that kind of straight ahead jazz is, very horn based, piano, double bass, drums. And yes, of course, they're just cited Wes Montgomery. There is, a thriving jazz guitar tradition in straight ahead jazz. But I suppose the gypsy jazz or the jazz manouche approach gives, kind of an alternative approach, a different approach to these songs and to understand and a different understanding of jazz as an American music. It takes it somewhere else, through France, through Roma communities as well. So it's it gives a little different take, I suppose.
Yeah. So the style of music, you mentioned earlier that it takes popular music at the time and kind of puts it through its own unique lens. And I wondered, in what setting would we have heard this type of music? Is this music that we would hear in clubs? Is this music that was only heard in the concert hall? Where would we traditionally hear this? And then maybe if you could talk about where you normally play this music now. Are you more of a cafe bar band, or are you gracing prestigious concert halls?
Well, definitely not the latter. Yeah, we're not prestigious at all. I mean, from what I know of this music, it played around campfires, played in cafes, played in clubs.
And also, you know, you think about how influenced by American music and how much they loved American music. You think about the success of the jazz players over in Europe.
Where they weren't appreciated here yeah, in many ways. Yeah. So yeah, perhaps that kind of heterogeneity that you have in Europe that, you know, may have been, you know, lacking in America, you know, that found a home and found some, it found a, like a ripe setting to become, European or to become Gypsy or to become Roma or what have you. But for us, you know, it's fun and it does lend itself well to a restaurant and bar setting. You know, we do use amplifiers when we play out. You know, we're really happy to be here in this beautiful studio playing acoustically. It's nice to really hear each other without the clinking of glasses and chatter. Though we do love that setting, it is really nice to be here. Because it's not rock based music, we're not, you know, playing in front of a wall of amplifiers. We don't need a PA system, so just a light bit of amplification, and we supply a nice musical backdrop for people to enjoy their evenings at the places that we play.
He wants to say musical wallpaper, but but he knows he'd be stealing my term. I want to like add on to that and say that I think it makes for what we do now. Like, we often play at Martini's downtown. We've played at the Grand Traverse Distillery, some other sort of small venues like that. And since we don't have the PA and we're not trying to drive loud instruments over and get louder than the crowd, it makes a big difference. We're playing instrumentally and we're playing with more subtle, I think, timbre on the instruments, so that people can talk and can socialize and not feel like they're ruining the ambiance of the sound. They can still hear us over in the corner. And that's something I really like about it. In other groups where you do have like a vocalist or somebody who's a songwriter and wants to have their lyrics understood, there's kind of a, you know, it's cordial, but there's a combativeness between like how loud we need to get that so you can hear it versus how quiet the audience needs to be in order to hear it. And sometimes people just want to go out and have a drink and talk with their friends and have this kind of music wafting around the room while they do it, and have it to be able to look over and see actual people playing actual instruments at the same time. That ambiance is, I think, something that probably was loved back and was just normal back in the 40s and 30s, you know, when there weren't PA systems and there weren't, you know, I don't know. There's,
right. It would have been, a record player or radio. Yeah. I don't think you would find that in your restaurant or the cafe.
But then you could also,
maybe.
You could also just take the band that's playing in the corner, however, and Edith Piaf could walk into the room and sing a song with them. You know, and then everybody would shut up and listen because it's Edith Piaf. But the backing band, you know, could be almost the same instrumentation. So there's a whole, you know, world of recordings like that out there where Django's playing in, you know, with a larger band backing up someone like Edith Piaf, or maybe, you know, an accordion player, soloist or something, you know. Yeah. So it's not only a good core sound on its own, but it also is a good, you know, instrumentation for a core of a backing band too. Yeah. I'll stop talking now.
Yeah, I agree.
I love the way you described it. It's kind of a sweet spot of sorts. I've been on the receiving end of some complaints for, as playing as a trombonist, and you show up in that setting, there's always people that weren't expecting that, let's say. And so it's good to be able to walk the line, yeah, so to speak.
It is nice that there are a lot of places popping up that are calling themselves listening rooms. Mm. So they're at least kind of shouting to the rooftops, everybody be quiet, you know.
Disclaimer.
Yeah, when the music's playing, but we don't really have to fight with that, which is nice. So
I'd love to hear another tune if you like, and I promise I won't make any requests this time.
Make requests. It's called Douce Ambiance, and it's another Django tune, and yeah, I think a kind of standard for this style of music.
You're listening to Let's Hear It. We're in the WMUK Takeda studio with the Birdseed Salesman. That was great. Lots of driving energy. I could see how, Jay, your right arm just must be really hurting after the end of this. You know, earlier we talked, or we kind of joked about the name of your ensemble and how it could be a collective of sorts. But I often joke that there's only like 2 degrees of separation in the music community. And you mentioned earlier that you have another band that you're a part of, and I just wonder if you could talk about the Kalamazoo music scene in general, just the collaboration that occurs and how easy it is and how often, you know, you end up being involved in lots of different projects and what that's like. Is that something that kind of just happens because you love playing music and you end up playing with lots of different people, or is that something that you're actively trying to do?
I would This is Jay, right?
Yes. Was that you?
Yeah, I think I've been in Kalamazoo a long time and playing a lot. And just over time, I've been lucky enough to play with a lot of different people in a lot of different styles. And, you know, I think sometimes, I don't know, for instance, when Helen showed up and started playing with us, she has a group of friends and acquaintances that, you know, are all like in the, the jazz program, jazz faculty. So, you know, I've gotten to know just from our gigs, some of them, and it's really been a great experience and super daunting to be, you know, I remember the first one, like we were playing at Water Street, and all of a sudden the faculty of WMUK's School of Music walks in, you know, and I'm sitting here pretending like I know how to play jazz. And so, but that is a great experience, you know, that's kind of what I'm shooting for, you know, I want to be challenged like that. And I think, you know, just we all get into an ensemble like this or into a band and you meet other people who are associated with that type of music and, I don't know, connections get made. And the longer you stick around a place, you know, the more that becomes a little bit of a spider web-like. So I think I probably bridge this band to some other, you know, people in other worlds of Kalamazoo music. And there are a lot of them.
Yeah.
I think of you as one of the cores in this community, Jay.
Yeah, without Jay Gavin, neither I nor Helen would have any kind of music career here in Kalamazoo. And that can't be said enough that, yeah, Jay has an important and unique perspective on music here in Kalamazoo, you know, not only as a musician, as a proprietor, as a instrument maker, among the many hats he wears, as an educator and as a historian. And, you know, there needs to be a book on like Kalamazoo music or something that, you know, kind of a musicological history or something that that you'd be in a good position to write.
Shucks.
Too humble, Jay. And, you know, speaking of the name, now that it's because I always feel compelled
Jay's just
to...
beating up on me this whole time. Chicken picking and coming up with the name.
Yeah, is there a reason for that? Sometimes names can be completely arbitrary.
It's a film by a director whose name I won't mention for a variety of reasons, but it's a film about a jazz guitar player who is you know, kind of a jerk, and he says, you know, he's the best jazz guitar player ever. This is the movie Sweet Lowdown, and he says he's the best jazz guitar player you've ever seen, except for some gypsy guy in Europe. Meaning Django Reinhardt, and there's a scene where this jerk of a guitar player goes to, I don't know, some place in the Midwest, the equivalent of Kalamazoo, and essentially trolls a talent show, and he introduces himself as a birdseed salesman. So so yeah, I suppose our name has a sordid past, a suspect origins. But yeah, watching this film, Sweet Lowdown, yeah, seeing that scene, I thought, oh, you know, that's kind of funny from a movie. So we can be the birdseed salesman. And we've wrangled over this name, you know, we're trying to come up with a more
gender neutral
name, especially after Helen joined the band. And we had tried to come up with another name, but then we played the Fretboard Festival, and that had been booked in advance, and the material had been printed, and so we couldn't update the name. So after that, I guess Helen felt like she
I
lost the war.
I decided I could be a salesman.
She could be a salesman. So yeah. There's no neuter form of salesmen. So salespersons. But
doesn't have quite the same.
You know. So yeah, I guess it has to do with the origins in this movie, not the jerk guitar player.
I had to ask. So you mentioned earlier. Well, I know Nathan, you're a history professor here at WMU, and you mentioned Jay's proprietor and Helen. We didn't get to what you do.
I'm the inveterate freelancer.
Yes.
I have no secure day gig. Having just, come from New York 2.5 years ago, I guess now, just really fallen in love with this scene. I do some non-music related freelance stuff that I was doing in New York. We're in the same time zone, so absolutely nothing has changed. It's all on the phone, so nobody sees my face. And aside from that, I had been doing in New York more and more sort of theater and dance work, which meant playing with the looper and electronics, plugging my violin through that and creating pieces for live theater and for live dance.
Wonderful.
And so probably in the last, it started really picking up maybe about 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, doing more and more of that in New York.
Helen is slumming it with Jay and I. She is a phenomenal composer, and if you get a chance to hear her, she's being modest in what she's describing with the electronics and the looping, but I mean, it's really at the forefront of kind of electroacoustic composition. And I remember the first time I saw her, she was just, you were opening for somebody essentially, and I left after that because it was so good. I didn't want to see the person she was opening for. I was so amazed. But yeah, if you see Helen Yee on a bill around here, go see it. Go see her perform. It's really good.
It's wonderful.
Thanks, Nathan. Thanks for the shout out.
Everyone's so humble. I love it. Before we go, I'd like to thank each of you for coming in today, Helen Yee, Jay Gavin, and Nathan Tabor, the Birdseed Sales people, the Birdseed Salesman,
Salesforce.
Salesforce.
Yeah. We went through all these names already.
Yeah. So if you've got one for us, yeah, some notes.
If we'd like to find out more about you, where could we do that?
Oh, we're horrible with promotion. We do have a Facebook page that we put up our dates on, but we can be found usually picking and bowing at Martini's on the weekends. We are often there.
I'd love to hear another tune, actually.
Yeah, there was a movie called La Chodrome. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but it was totally about the Roma and different sort of musics, not only the gypsy jazz, but more traditional Roma music as well. And there was a scene in there where they had this song called Shavolo Swing. It's written by Shavolo Schmidt.